Hello and welcome to the MB Om podcast, where you will learn to master the business of yoga with guests from around the world who have experienced becoming successful yoga teachers, studio owners, and much more. Now, here's your host, Amanda Kingsmith.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the MB Om podcast. Today on the podcast, I have a yoga teacher and meditation instructor, as well as personal life coach, Tracy Delfs. And Tracy Delfs is somebody that I know from Canmore, Alberta, and she's based out of Canmore and Calgary in Alberta. And I really wanted to talk to Tracy because she has a really cool background. She's been an entrepreneur for about 15 years now, and she's done massage therapy. She teaches yoga. She runs her own retreats. She does life coaching, and she's got a pretty solid business set up online and a lot of different pieces sort of to her puzzle. And the more that I teach, the more I realize that I don't want to be teaching 20 to 25 classes a week, and that creating a business around yoga is something that really interests me. And so for those of you out there who sort of feel the same way, this is the perfect person to talk to. So without further ado, here's Tracy. Well, thanks so much for coming on the podcast today, Tracy. It's super awesome to have you here.
Yay. I'm happy to be here, Amanda.
Yay. Did you want to start by telling me a little bit about how you discovered yoga, how you got into yoga?
Yeah, my first experience with yoga is I have a kinesiology degree. And in 1988, so a long time ago, I did my first fitness class, or my first yoga class, as actually part of my school program in kinesiology. So I actually got credit for my first yoga classes I've ever done.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's pretty funny. And it was great because it was with a traditional teacher from India, and it was a really unique experience for me. And that was my beginning of yoga.
And so were you kind of intrigued by it? Was it like, oh, I want to search this out elsewhere and continue to do that? Or did you kind of discover it later on?
It definitely planted the seed, and then I got more into my outdoor activities, but I would still go to the odd yoga class here and there. But it wasn't until the late 90s that I got into it on more of a regular basis.
Okay. And the yoga scene must have been pretty different back in like the late 90s than it is now.
Yeah, there wasn't a lot of yoga going on, that's for sure. and then I just remember I was having some issues with my wrists and my back and stuff. And I asked a friend that was a yoga teacher if she would do some private trainings with me. And then she said, oh, you should just go do your own teacher training and learn how to do the practice yourself. So in 2000, I did my teacher training because it was actually difficult to even find a lot of yoga teachers back then.
Yeah.
So I just thought, oh, I'll just learn how to do it on my own. And then that's when I really fell in love with yoga and got really committed to my own daily practice, and then started teaching shortly after that.
That's amazing. It's so interesting. It's been kind of a consistent theme with people I've interviewed on the podcast, saying how it was really hard to find trainings, hard to find classes sort of in like the early 2000s. And I was talking to somebody pretty recently who told me that there's approximately 13,000 new yoga teachers coming out of North America every year now.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's hard to believe.
I know. I don't know how legitimate that stat is, but I mean, based on the amount of people that I meet who are like, yeah, I'm going to do a yoga teacher training, or I've done a yoga teacher training, I kind of believe it. Like, there's a lot of people who are coming through these programs now.
Yeah, no, I totally believe it as well. Yeah, it's a big difference in 15 years for sure.
Totally. And so when you started teaching, did you jump into teaching in studios, or how did your career progress as a yoga teacher?
Well, just shortly after I did my teacher training, I went to Europe and I was working with the National Alpine Ski Team.
Oh, cool.
And so the first yoga classes I ever taught were actually to our Canadian national team. And it was the first classes with the men's alpine team. And it was pretty funny because they weren't very flexible at all.
Yeah.
And so I just taught them out in the grass, and then, yeah, it was interesting for sure. And so I initially started teaching the athletes, and then I started teaching the general public in Canmore out of one of my friends. She had a little studio where she did Pilates and yoga. And when I first started teaching some classes, I would only have like two people come. And then it was just neat to see how it built up over the years, because back then there wasn't that many people doing yoga as well as teaching yoga. And so I just definitely started with the athletes and then the general public, and started to teach more of the community classes in the town where I was living, which is called Canmore.
Yeah, that's amazing. It's so funny to think about, you know, knowing Canmore as I know it now, how, you know, two people only showing up for a yoga class is just like, that's mind blowing. Yeah. That would never happen now.
I know, it's pretty funny. And then I remember I had a phone call from some people that wanted to start up a yoga studio in Canmore. And they asked, do you think there's enough people that are interested in yoga to start up a studio? I'm like, I don't know. Like, my classes are getting busier. Like, I was teaching at the community center, and I said, they're getting busier, but I don't know if there's enough people interested, you know, to open up a studio. But then again, fast forward, you know, 16 years later, and how many classes there are in Canmore, and how many studios, and the classes are all busy. And so yeah, it's just really neat to see how the trend really has just gotten so much more bigger over the years.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. That's really cool to think about and to just see like how much it's grown.
Mm-hmm, for sure.
And so with your career, were you teaching yoga full time, or was that ever something you wanted to do?
No, I've never taught yoga full time. The most I was when I was teaching in Canmore, at one time I was teaching about 10 classes a week, and I think that was the most I've ever taught, like, in, you know, consistently for a period of time. And because I find for myself, I just like too much diversity. So back then I was teaching yoga, and I was also a massage therapist back then, and life coaching and teaching meditation. So a good variety. Mm-hmm. And that's what really worked for me.
Is that something you would recommend to other people to consider, having something else on the side? Or do you think it really depends on like person to person?
Well, I think it definitely depends on the person. But also what I really felt is that all my different businesses really fed each other as well. Like, for example, people got to know me through my yoga classes, and then they'd come to see me as a massage therapist or as a life coach, or they would start to come to my retreats or to my meditation classes. And then same thing, if someone was at one of my retreats, then, you know, they might start coming to my classes or come to me as a massage therapist. And so I think, again, that diversity allows you to just naturally feed all of the different things that you're doing too, from mm-hmm. a marketing perspective too.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's cool to have like complementary interests that you're kind of pursuing in different directions, where your clients can kind of cross over with one another.
Yeah, I mean, it'd be definitely different if I was, you know, part-time yoga teacher, part-time mechanic, part-time chef. They might not go over as much.
Yeah. Yeah, it's something that I've really thought about quite a bit in with my journey as a yoga teacher, is that, like, you know, how many classes do I want to teach in a week, and what else do I want to be doing? And something that I found the more consistently that I teach is that it's way too energetically consuming for me to teach probably more than 10 classes in a week. Like, I think my ideal is more like around like 5 to 7, even maybe like more around like 5. And I've thought about people who teach like 20 to 25 classes, and I respect them. I have a lot of respect that they can do that. And I've just found that that's not for me.
Yeah. I can't imagine teaching that many classes. Like I said, like 10 was definitely my max. And I find when I teach fewer classes that, you know, whether it's the yoga or the meditation, it's sort of the same energy output. that I just feel like I can focus more on quality versus quantity. So when I show up, I like to really be there and teach the best class I can. And if I'm teaching too many, I just feel a bit drained. So that's where, again, I like the diversity. So wherever I'm showing up, I can be there fully. So if I'm like coaching someone, I can be there fully, or teaching a class, I can be there fully, or doing a presentation. So again, that diversity really works for me. So.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. I think that that's really good advice for people to consider just based on themselves personally.
Mm-hmm.
And in terms of creating your business with meditation and life coaching, at what point did you do that?
Well, it was kind of interesting. Why I really got into yoga was because I first started studying with my Zen master, Thich Nhat Hanh, in the late 90s. And my back was so sore sitting in long meditation periods that I decided, you know, that was one of the reasons why I wanted to get into a more regular yoga practice. And then same with my wrist being sore from massage is why I wanted to get into the yoga more. So, and then when I was into the yoga, then I started to lead yoga retreats. And then I just started to bring the mindfulness teachings that I had been learning from Thich Nhat Hanh, from going over to study with him on a regular basis in Europe. I would just started to immerse those into my retreats. And then I just had people within the community ask if I would start teaching the meditation classes. So it just really organically formed of just bringing the different things together. And then with the life coaching, I've just always been really interested in positive psychology. And just when I found out about life coaching, it really resonated with me. So I got into life coaching just a few years after I became a certified yoga teacher, and just really, again, love how they complement each other. Because the life coaching just really allowed me to work with people to get them to look at their whole life. Mm-hmm. And then the yoga and the meditation are part of that. So again, just I really feel they all complement each other.
Yeah. Yeah. I would agree with that for sure.
Mm-hmm. And again, just really like the diversity within my workday to do the different things.
Yeah, it's really cool to hear that you've done so many diverse things, but at the same time, they kind of come back to this like overarching, I guess, like end goal or sort of like thing that somebody might want out of life, like finding happiness or health or, you know, just living a more positive life, that sort of thing.
Yeah, because I feel sort of, I mean, my biggest passion is to teach people how to calm their minds and teach them how to live in the present moment. And I find with all those different areas, it allows me to help people to find that place. And it's going to resonate with different people because some people prefer more the physical movement of the yoga. Some people prefer more the seated meditation. Other people like to just really integrate it within their life and making sure they're on their life purpose. And that's, again, where the life coaching comes in. So I feel that it's like all these different areas will lead to the same place.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I think that that's awesome. It's also cool that you discovered meditation sort of before you were practicing yoga.
Yeah. Again, like I was introduced to yoga, but I wasn't totally hooked into yoga.
Yeah.
And I definitely got into the yoga initially for the physical part of it, but then, you know, soon realized that the asana part of the yoga is only 1/8 of what it's all about. And again, that's when I really wanted to bring more of the mindfulness meditation into the yoga and just how they really complement each other.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. I think that it's such an important part. And it's interesting because a lot of people don't realize if they haven't done a teacher training that there are all these other aspects. They sort of just show up and they're like, okay, let's get moving now. Like let's do yoga.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I feel that's something that makes me a little bit sad when I see what's happening with yoga in North America is that I feel there's been a lot of emphasis just on the asana, the physical part of the practice, mm-hmm. and that people are missing the overall umbrella of what yoga is really about, which is more the spiritual aspect and just to, you know, bring in all the different limbs of the yoga practice, so the breathing, pranayama, et cetera.
Yeah, it's really interesting that you say that. I was talking to Ryan about this yesterday, about how even when I started practicing yoga, it was very much about like the exercise component for me. And I remember my first few classes, like even when the teacher was like, relax, I was like, okay, I gotta like, I don't know, like clench my abs or something. Like I gotta make sure I'm working really hard in this class. So it kind of justifies my like workout of the day. And I was just laughing at like, you know, poor little, you know, 19-year-old girl who has no idea what she's doing. And just, I guess, feeling like a little bit compassionate for her and that how that's how I practiced yoga. That's what I thought yoga was about. And now it's, you know, if I want a workout, I'm probably going to go do something that's not yoga.
Yeah. So that's interesting self-reflection.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah, definitely.
And again, you know, I think it's great that a lot of people are getting into yoga for the physical part, because if that's what's going to get them in the door, then that's great. And then I think just naturally over time, just like you, they're going to realize like, wow, there's all these other parts to yoga and all these other benefits of yoga versus just the physical part. So again, I think it's, you know, whatever it takes to get people into yoga is great. And then I think those that are wanting to progress and to get the other, like the real jewels and the gifts of yoga, will bring in more of those other elements.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I think it's something that, you know, you get this like physical, this really great physical feeling after you practice yoga. Your body's really limber. You feel really good because a lot of your tension and tightness is relieved. But then you also get this calm sort of state of mind. And I think that's what kept me going back to yoga. And eventually I was like, oh, I'm not even going to yoga for necessarily the physical aspect anymore. I'm more going because I go crazy when I don't.
Yeah, no, for sure. And it's interesting. I had a major injury 4 months ago, so I couldn't actually do any yoga at all for 4 months. The surgeon said I was on the anti-yoga program for 4 months because I could totally re-injure myself and open up the surgery. And so, but I was missing the physical practice of it, but because I know yoga is so much more than just the physical aspect of it, I really still felt like I had yoga in my life, even though I couldn't actually do the asana part of it. Yeah. And now I'm excited to start doing the practice again, even though I feel like I'm way back at before even being a beginner of yoga, just because I, with the surgery, and I'm, you know, can barely touch my knees when I used to be able to bring my hands on the floor. But it's kind of this exciting aspect of it too, of just realizing what it feels like to be a beginner yogi again.
Yeah, definitely. And, it takes you back to that.
Yeah. And I feel excited to see where my practice can go and how it can develop over time again. So it's been a neat journey too, for sure.
Yeah. It's obviously like it's a good thing that comes out of a bad thing, I guess. It's like a good way of looking at something that's not so great.
Mm-hmm. And again, I think it's just, even with being back and teaching classes now, I can't even demo all the poses properly and stuff. But again, I think it actually has made me a better yoga teacher, because there's just this greater understanding of what the participants are going through and improves the cueing and all of that. So again, just to, you know, and reminding different yoga teachers that it's not really all about the asanas. It's about what else you can bring to the class.
Yeah, for sure. I love that. And so having sort of three different businesses at the moment, you must do a lot of like self-promotion and marketing.
Yeah. And again, like I said, the different businesses really help to fuel each other. So for example, in my mindfulness meditation classes, I'll talk about my yoga retreats, or, you know, just will, you know, let people know about that I am a life coach as well. And just, again, those different aspects really, really do help each other. And definitely, I feel like I've been an entrepreneur for over 20 years, and I feel with being an entrepreneur, like basically you are your own marketer. And if you want to succeed in what you're doing, the marketing is actually a huge part of your business. And you need to make the time for it, and you need to make it a priority and figure out what ways work best for you, because it's going to be different for every person too. So just to realize it's part of the game. If you want to, you know, be a self-employed yoga teacher, you're going to have to market yourself as well. And one of the things over the years with being an entrepreneur is, because I've had such a diversity in what I do, is I'll build up one aspect of my business before I let go of another part. So, for example, I'm not doing massage therapy anymore. I haven't done it for a couple of years. But I built up the other parts of my business before I let go of that. And then I'll do the same as I'm building different aspects within my business now. I'll build those up before I let go of something else. And I just find... that's really worked for me over the years. Like, for example, right now, my major focuses are the mindfulness meditation, the mindfulness and yoga retreats. I lead a lot of workshops and do a lot of presenting on mindfulness and stress management. And then I still have the life coaching and stress management aspect of my career. So those are the areas that I focus on now mainly.
And for you, what have you found is the best, like, marketing tools or platforms for marketing?
Well, definitely creating email lists. So, for example, whenever anybody does a workshop with me or a class or comes to retreat, I will get their email addresses and send out information, but then also I have them on the email list, so I'll let them know, like, via newsletters what other things I have coming up, what other retreats and classes, et cetera. Facebook, to let people know what's happening. Those are the main ones for me. I don't spend a lot of time on social media because I don't like spending a ton of time on my computer. But as well, another thing that I'm working on is doing more online programs. So I'll be doing more of the social media stuff as I move more into that. But again, we'll just find, I think it's really important to just pick, you know, a couple of social media aspects and then really focus on those versus trying to do like everything and getting burnt out and not really doing good with anything. So I think that would be one of my recommendations too, is find the ones that you actually like to do. And then focus on those, like you're doing the podcast and you know, you love those. So that's a good area for you to focus on.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's really good advice because there's so many forms of social media. I mean, on top of the major ones that people think of, like Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, there's Google Plus where you can post stuff. There's Snapchat, there's LinkedIn, there's, I don't know. I think there's still more than that too. And it can become a lot when you're, I know even for our, you know, Ryan and I's travel podcast or this podcast, it's, you know, a new episode comes out and it's, I send the links to the person that I talked with so that they know that their episode's out, because I think that's really important. And then it's like, there's a newsletter and then there's Facebook. And then I'm like, okay, what other things do I have to post this on? It can become like super overwhelming after a while when you're trying to keep up with all these different things and all these different audiences.
Yeah. So I think, again, you know, focusing more on quality than quantity.
Yeah.
And just sort of pick the ones that work for you and then go deeper into those versus spreading yourself too thin and not really getting any traction anywhere.
Yeah. I think that's really, really good advice for myself and for anyone to adhere to. And would you suggest people definitely having a website?
Yeah, I do definitely feel that website, it gives you sort of a home base where people can go. However, you know, what I am learning about the online marketing and stuff is, you know, sometimes it doesn't need to be like this full on website. It could just be even a landing page, again, where you're getting people's email addresses and building that contact list. So, but I think whenever you're putting something out there, you want, you know, you want people to know where they can go to find out more versus just giving out all this great information. And then they're like, oh, that was interesting. Yeah. But if they want to learn more, they need to know where to go to find more, I feel.
Yeah, I think that that's a really good idea. And because your businesses are so connected, do you just keep one email list that you send like one sort of newsletter email to everyone?
Yes, currently that's where I'm at. As I start to go with more of an online program and the opt-in pages and stuff, then I'll have two email lists with that. So sort of more my online marketing and then the people that have been coming to my retreats and classes and have been clients for years.
Yeah.
And then the people that have been coming to my classes and retreats and are on that list, if they want, they can opt in to the other list too, but that would be optional.
Okay. Yeah, that's cool. I like that idea. Mm-hmm. It's always a little bit like, kind of always feels a little bit off when somebody just adds you to an email list and you're like, hey, I didn't sign up for this. You know, even if you really like that person and what they're doing, you would sign up. It's kind of just like that. Hey, I would have liked to have been asked before I was put on this.
Yeah. And that's where, again, when I get people's emails from classes and retreats, I just let them know that I only send out an email like once every season on average to let them know what's coming up. So that's where when I start to go to more of the online stuff and have more offerings, then I will invite them to opt into that. But it's totally optional because I totally agree because we're all getting over bombarded with emails right now. And so I really feel I really treat my email list a bit like gold too. Like I really want to respect them and not bombard them with too much.
Yeah, I think that that's an important thing to remember too, is like thinking about your own inbox and how much stuff you get in there and really creating something that's like going to be valuable for these people.
Yeah, and you definitely want to be giving things. So whenever I do an email, like an email newsletter, I like to give them information that, you know, that they can take away and use, or not just promoting everything I have going on.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a really good sort of thing to hit on, is like it not being this like, hey, buy this from me or come take this course with me. It's like, hey, I really appreciate you. Like, here's this information for you that's going to help you in your life. And then here's the other stuff about me as well.
Because, it's a relationship that you have going with them. So it's a two-way relationship. So, I know, I think that's really important for sure.
Yeah, I love that piece of advice. And in terms of like creating posters for workshops and whatnot, is that something that you do?
I do. Because of the online stuff, I don't do as much of that. When I first started teaching years ago, that was basically how people found out about what classes I had coming up, et cetera, were via posters. But again, it was because I was in a smaller town and that really worked. And it was funny because back then my yoga posters were the only ones up, whether it was a yoga class or a yoga retreat. And then nowadays those boards are so full.
Oh, they're crazy.
With so many yoga retreats and classes. And again, like when I first started, I didn't really know anyone else that was doing, that were doing yoga retreats. And, or like I said, there, you know, weren't really many other classes around. So again, things have changed a lot. So I think you have to be more creative about how you're doing, because obviously there's a lot more people out there advertising.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I worked at Lululemon for like just over a year, and there's a massive community board there. And I remember like right before the summer season, so probably right about now when people are offering a lot of retreats, a lot of offerings. It's like, there's actually no room for all the posters that we get. And that community board is massive. Like it takes up a good chunk of a wall.
I know. It's so funny.
Yeah. It's crazy.
For sure. So again, but it's great. And a lot of people are looking for retreats too. So there's a lot of retreats out there, but there's a lot of people looking for them too. And again, like with my yoga part of my business, I'm not teaching many yoga classes at all right now. It's just averaging like two classes a week. But I'm leading way more retreats every year. And sort of my focus with the yoga has gone more to the retreats and then more with the mindfulness meditation, because with moving to the city, there's definitely a demand for that.
So. Yeah. Yeah. I think it's cool to kind of like change your business as things change in your life and really looking at like the place that you're in and what sort of the market needs.
No, for sure. And the other thing with being a yoga teacher too. So for example, with having a major injury is, you know, it's something to keep in mind too for yoga teachers is I don't think you want to rely 100% on a business that really you need your body for. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can just cue a class, but it does help when I can at least kind of demo the poses.
Yeah.
And so that was it. I think again, it's good to have a diversity with what you do as well.
Yeah, I think that that's a really good reminder because it's not like when you work at a corporate job or something and you've got sick days or a certain allotment of vacation, you don't have that time. And I was talking to a yoga teacher just the other day who's full-time yoga with private clients and workshops and in studio classes. He was saying like, I can't get sick. Like he's like, I can't get sick. I can't get hurt. Like that's my livelihood gone if those things happen. And he's like, that's a big stressor as, you know, choosing to do this full time.
Well, and also if people are doing it mainly full time, I really recommend to get disability insurance. Mm-hmm. And so any entrepreneur can get it and you can get short term and long term disability. And it's expensive, but I really think it's worth it. Like if you don't have any other means of income and you're relying on your body for your income, I think disability insurance should be a priority. And especially when I was being a massage therapist and a yoga teacher full time and before I got into life coaching too, it just is like that's my whole income is relying on my body. So I've had disability insurance and I've used disability insurance a couple of times from injuries because I want to still go mountain biking and I want to do things that I love and those things can lead to injuries. So yeah, I think it's something to keep in mind.
Yeah, I think that that's good advice for people is having insurance that'll cover you in case something happens. It's something that, you know, when you have to fork something out right away, people kind of veer away from. And Ryan and I actually did a travel podcast on this because he actually ended up having to get his appendix out being down in the US and which is kind of crazy. Like he just had stomach pain and it didn't go away. So we finally went to the hospital and they're like, yep, you're going to be in surgery within an hour. And had he not had travel insurance, like that is thousands and thousands of dollars. And a lot of people will just be like, oh, I don't want to pay, you know, $300 to $500 for travel insurance. But, you know, you never know when something's going to happen. You just can't predict those things.
Definitely. Yeah. No, I think, again, it's just about looking at the big picture of everything. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's great to be an optimist in life and to think that things aren't going to happen. But again, I was just doing, you know, going for a little skate just after New Year's and ended up spending 5 days at the hospital with major surgery on my hamstring muscles. So
wow.
You never know, right?
Yeah. So yeah. Things
can
change.
Happen fast.
Yeah. They change in an instant for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm curious, you said you started running retreats sort of at a time period where not a lot of people were doing it. How did you learn to run retreats, or did you just sort of dive in and then learn as you went?
Yeah, I definitely just dove in because I'd never even, like when I first started leading retreats, I'd never even been to a yoga retreat before. So I just really did it all organically and learned as I went along. And also with my retreats, I never actually went out looking for places to do retreats. Everyone just contacted me and I thought, oh, will you lead a yoga retreat? Okay. So it's really neat how it's all just come to me too. And then just within that, just really figured out, you know, what seemed like a good flow for a day. Like initially I used to pack my days too full at the retreats and then I would always get feedback after every retreat. Like, you know, if you have any suggestions to make this retreat better. And I think that's really important. Mm-hmm. And then people are like, oh, we want more free time in the afternoon. I'm like, sweet. It gives me a break.
You know? Yeah.
So, or that's too early to start doing yoga or that's too late. And, you know, so just from feedback from people and just seeing, the flow of the day, then I just really, you know, over the years figured out a good flow that seems to really work.
Yeah, I think that that's cool. Like learning from experience, learning from people who were at the retreat and taking their like feedback and changing things next time.
Mm-hmm. And I really recommend too with leading retreat that you have a logistics person that takes care of the logistical part so you can focus just on being the facilitator of the retreat part. Mm-hmm. And I'm lucky everywhere I teach my retreats, there's other people that are taking care of the logistics of the accommodations and the food and actually doing the registration and everything too. So then it allows me to focus on the marketing part of getting the people there and then to just be fully present in the facilitation part and not having to worry about all the details of, you know, oh, it's too cold in the room or the food isn't ready or whatever it might be.
Yeah. So. Yeah, that's really good advice because then you can just like really stay, like you said, present with your students and be that person who's, you know, guiding them through their yoga practice or their meditation or, you know, whatever it is that they're doing.
And then, yeah, because I was just going to say, it takes a lot of energy to hold a retreat space because you're with people. It's different when you think about how much energy it takes to lead a class and then you mm-hmm. multiply that by, you know, 48 hours or however long your retreat is.
Yeah.
You're really holding that space. So whenever you can give away sort of those little logistical things, it really helps you to keep your energy too.
Yeah, that's a good piece of advice. I was going to ask you just any other pieces of advice that you have for people who might want to run retreats who have, you know, no real background with it.
Yeah. So again, you know, I think a person needs to have a good following before you even try leading retreats. Mm-hmm. So I think you want to make sure that you have that. And then just to really find, you know, a place that you think is going to work for you and try to do a partnership with the people where you want to lead the retreat so that they can help with the marketing and that they're really on board of what your needs are and that you need it to be a quiet space and all these various things. So I think you need to really communicate with wherever you're leading it and create good relationships there. And then I think it's good, what I'm learning over the years is just to basically have the same retreat at the same place at the same time every year. And then from a marketing perspective, people just come to expect that.
Okay.
And because maybe people couldn't make it this year, but they know, well, next May, you'll be having a retreat there again. So if they can't do it this year, then maybe they'll plan for next year. And so I think there's something about just having that consistency versus something different every time.
Yeah. Yeah. And it kind of gives people that time to plan ahead, not only with like work schedules and family and that sort of thing, but also financially.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like, for example, I was looking at maybe running a retreat in Tuscany next spring. Mm-hmm. And then but also I'm running one in Mexico this fall. And I realized that it was going to be two international retreats that close together, as well as my like 9 other retreats that I lead more locally. Mm-hmm. Is going to be too much for me. I think both for myself, but also just sort of putting that on to my participants. So instead, I'm going to do 2000. So it's a long way out, but to start letting people know now, like May 2018, I'll be doing a retreat in Tuscany because it takes it's a lot of money to save up to go to Europe. Mm-hmm. And it gives people a lot of lead time to start planting that seed and, you know, the marketing, but also so they can plan and save for it.
Yeah, I think that's a really good idea because I know for me, it's like, you know, the financial cost of going on a retreat, especially something that's international and is not in Canada or the US, is something that I have to be prepared for to save.
Yeah, no, so I think, again, being realistic about things is mm-hmm. important to you when it comes to leading retreats, for sure.
Yeah.
You can get really excited and be like, oh, I'm going to do all these retreats in all these places. And then you realize, oh, people need more time than that to prepare for it.
So. Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Do you find that you have a lot of reoccurring people that come to your retreats? Like come to the same one every year or come to at least one of them every year? Or is it more like new people that kind of trickle in each year?
I would say it's probably about 25% of people that are repeat to like one of my retreats. So they might not go to the same place, but they might go on one of my other retreats instead. And then probably about 75% are new people.
Okay. And do you market anywhere online outside of your website? I know you said a little bit on social media. Are there any websites that you use to market your retreats?
Well, for myself, a lot of the places where I lead my retreat, they do most of the online marketing for me.
Okay.
And some of them have really good domain name search or just search engine. Search engine optimization and stuff. So they're getting good hits just with their own company. And then other ones are using, there are different yoga platforms out there that will help promote your retreats, like bookyogaretreats.com, I think is one of them. And there's different ones. So if you just Google yoga retreats, you'll often see like paid ads right at the top. And those are ones that you can advertise on.
Okay.
And some of them, and some of them, you pay them a percentage of your retreat, and other ones you just pay a flat amount to advertise on their site for 3 months or 6 months or a year, and it varies that way. But I would recommend that for people that are just getting started too, mm-hmm. if you want to get like the new people.
Yeah, definitely. Sure. I feel like it seems like it's probably one of the hardest parts about retreats is actually, you know, getting the people there, because you can get really excited about a location and a date and everything you're going to offer and like the amazing accommodation and food. But if you don't have people show up, then, you know, you ultimately can't do that retreat.
Yeah. So again, like we talked about earlier in our conversation, is the marketing is a huge part mm-hmm. of being an entrepreneur. And if you want to do retreats, like you have to take that part of it. You know, seriously, unless you have like a huge amount of following, just the people within your classes that want to come, then you might be fine, you know, to just get enough right there. But what I would do is do product research, you know, before you actually organize a retreat. So just say right within class, like say, for example, I'm going to do that with the testing one, is when I start doing emails out, I will be like, you know, who's interested in test me, send me an email and I'll keep you updated. So that I actually know if there's even enough interest before I go and put down, you know, €1,000 down on booking a retreat center without knowing I actually, you know, have people interested.
Yeah, definitely.
Because when you're doing retreats, a lot of those deposits are non-refundable. So you want to make sure you have the people before you start putting those big deposits down.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of finding a location to do a retreat, like how did you find the place in Tuscany?
I'm just Googling yoga retreats in Italy or different places, and that's how you can find them.
And so, then finding a location that kind of resonates with you and then starting a conversation with that person and just seeing if their price sort of matches yours, et cetera.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Yeah, and then going from there.
Cool.
For sure. And just, yeah, same with anywhere. Like, so if you have a place that you like if you love, you know, a certain place at the ocean or, you know, whatever resonates with you, place in the mountains, then, you know, just see what's available there and contact them for sure.
Have you had any experiences where somewhere's looked really great and everything's like going smoothly and then you get there and it's not as good as you'd anticipated, or has everything been pretty smooth for you?
So far I've been lucky where everything's been smooth. I'm leading my first retreat this year it's the second retreat where I haven't actually seen the place. The first time I did that was in Spain. I co-led a retreat in Spain and, the accommodations were maybe not quite what I expected. But I think it's really important when you're doing international retreats is just to let the people know that are registering that you're in a different country and they do things different and, you know, not to have the same expectations.
Yeah.
As people might have in North America. So I think, again, you just need to really educate people on that. so that they're not expecting certain standards in a different country.
So. Yeah. Yeah. That's a good way to sort of like communicate that to people. Like just as a gentle reminder, we're going to be in a foreign country and things are different in Spain than they are in Canada. Is that something that I would worry about is like putting money down and having all these people have like expectations that it's going to be amazing. And then you get there and you're kind of like, whoa, what did I get myself into? You know?
Yeah, no, for sure. And I think it's good if you can actually go and, you know, do some research. So I did that like I was just on the Cancun side of Mexico and went down to Playa del Carmen and all these places and checked out different retreat centers. And some of them looked amazing online. And you got there and like, whoa, I'm so glad I didn't go ahead and book a retreat here.
Yeah.
And then other places that I didn't even find online, I'm like, wow, this would be amazing to lead a retreat here. So you can't always just go by the photos online. Like it's good to go check them out if you can.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting what photos can do. I mean, I don't have experience in running retreats, but I'm just thinking about, with apartments, like there's a few apartments that we've, you know, looked at photos and it looks really, really spectacular and you get there and it's not that it's bad. It's just like, okay, this photo really makes this room look a lot bigger than it actually is. Or, you know, I don't know what you did to make those counters so shiny, but they're not that shiny in person type thing.
It kind of reminds me of online dating.
Yeah. It's like kind of same,
what your
same.
Look like.
Yeah. Like how old is this photo?
But no, I think it's important to keep that in mind. And that's even like with the Chesney retreat, because it would be expensive for people to go over there, is I feel like I would actually like to see the property or at least have someone else I know see the property before I get people to put down that kind of, you know, money on it too.
Yeah. Yeah, so. Totally. Yeah. Cause it's a big investment for the people who are kind of putting trust in you, and it's sort of your name's on the line. And obviously that company or that location's also, they want to keep their reputation up to probably a certain extent. I think it just gets harder when you do go that international route and expectations are different in other countries.
Mm-hmm. No, for sure. So again, I think a lot of yoga teachers just sort of get this like, oh, I just want to lead yoga retreats and it's going to be all so magical. You know, and it is like if everything is flowing properly, but again, you need to be really realistic and you need to do your homework and you need to know what you're getting into and all the responsibilities of it. Like
yeah.
You're saying.
Yeah, and definitely.
You feel that responsibility of, you know, like hoping that people are okay with their accommodations and, you know, that their travel there was safe and all of these various things. And again, when you're getting into the country, there's all of that, those other aspects too, like the safety and stuff.
Yeah, 100%. That's a really, really good point. I think too, everything you said is like very, very valid. And it kind of brings me to talking about like, what are some of the biggest business lessons that you've learned throughout your career as a yoga teacher, massage therapist, life coach, meditation instructor, etc.?
Wow. That's a big one. I think, well, they're all, all of the different things I do are connected in the sense that they're all in the service industry.
Yeah.
And working with people. So I think one of the biggest lessons I've learned is self-care. And that I need to make sure that I make self-care a priority and that I always just keep boundaries with my time and not overdo it, because it's really easy to burn out in all those different industries. So, for example, I learned over time when I lead a yoga and mindfulness retreat, I need to take 2 days off afterwards to recover and give myself that space, because if I lead a retreat and then come right back into a day of teaching classes and coaching clients and stuff, then I'm going to get drained really easy.
Yeah.
So that's just one example. So I think self-care is for sure a priority, and that's where I would have concerns about people teaching 20, 25 classes a week is, I don't think it's a question if you're going to burn out. It's going to be a question of when you're going to burn out, because I don't think you can keep up that kind of pace for long periods of time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would tend to agree with that as well, at least like knowing myself personally. And I think that I love that that's the first like piece of big advice that you gave, because I think that it's so, so, so important to care for yourself, whether, you know, sleep, nutrition, your own practice, if it's yoga or maybe it's running or meditation, whatever it is, doing something for you. And I think that you've probably found this as an entrepreneur, but it's amazing to set your own schedule, but it's also really easy to spend your entire time working, because if you've got so much stuff on the go, and it's like this reminder of, okay, I got to do something for me today.
Mm-hmm. No, for sure. And I think within that, like to actually have a schedule and to book off times where you just don't work, you know, say for example, my husband and I, Tuesdays is date night, so I don't book any, I never book clients on Tuesday night or, you know, do any workshops or anything on Tuesday nights, because I'm already, you know, teaching a meditation class on Monday nights, a yoga class on Wednesday night. Sometimes I do workshops on Thursday night. Sometimes they lead retreats on the weekend, so I never book anything on the Tuesday night. And even my year, I'll look ahead and I'll plan out my retreats and workshops for the year. And then that'll be it. I won't take on any more. So I still have enough weekends just to play and do my own things that I love to do.
Yeah. It's important to have that time, because otherwise you start, you know, like any job, you start resenting it. You start disliking it.
Yeah. So again, I think it's about the quality versus the quantity. Mm-hmm. And then within that, you know, that's again where you need to make sure that you're being paid what you're worth, so that you don't have to be, you know, working yourself like crazy and burning out. So again, focus more on the quality versus the quantity mm-hmm. of what you're doing.
And in terms of like, if somebody's teaching full-time yoga and they're, you know, teaching a lot because they need to make that money, would you suggest transitioning more into like offering workshops, getting more private clients, stuff that pays a little bit more?
Yeah, definitely. So again, like if you just do the math, like say, for example, if you were working with a private client at say $80 an hour and you're teaching a class at $40 an hour, if you do the math, if you just multiply it by 10, you know, that's a big difference. Mm-hmm. And also the energy going out in it with a private client versus a class is a big difference too. So it's not only, you know, the time, but it's how much energy you're putting out. And also if you're teaching a class, you have to show up a lot, you know, quite a while before the class and ask the questions after the class. Whereas with a private client, you can just have really clear boundaries with your time and you know, okay, there are hours done.
Yeah. So. Yeah, definitely. I think that's something too. If you're teaching somewhere that's not that close to your house, you can spend so much time driving. If you live in a city with a lot of traffic, you can spend, you know, like you kind of said before, it can end up being sort of like 3 hours of your time for like maybe $30 to $50. And it seems fine when you're like, okay, yeah, I make, you know, $30 for an hour of my time, or I make $50 for an hour of my time. And then you factor in getting there early, staying after, maybe tidying up after the class, and as well as your commute to and from, and then also the time that it takes for your preparation for the class. Mm-hmm. Even if you're not somebody who sequences beforehand, I think that there's still, you know, time that goes into thinking about what you want to teach and that sort of thing.
No, definitely. So yeah, it's interesting because I have a lot of people asking like, oh, well, you teach meditation down in South Calgary. Calgary's where I'm living now. Mm-hmm. And you know, I will teach just south of downtown, but I won't teach in the deep south because I just don't like driving through heavy traffic, or just don't like driving around the city. So I teach local, and if I am going anywhere, then I'll teach two classes so that it's worth my time to go there.
Yeah.
So for example, I teach corporate, so I'll teach a meditation and a yoga class at the same place, but then it's worth taking the train downtown and spending the time there, but it's not worth going just for one class.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So I really, even when I lived in Canmore, which there wasn't much travel time, I would staff my classes. So teach two classes in a row. So again, it's worth my time to go there. And if people can do that, I think you really need to look at how much you're being paid from the moment you leave your house to the moment you get back. And then, so if it is 3 hours and you're making $30, you're actually only making $10 an hour if you're gone for 3 hours.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good way to think about it.
Yeah. So just how can, I think again, how can you work smarter and not harder? And yeah. I think a lot of people, when they think of yoga, they want to teach yoga just for the love of yoga. And again, I love yoga and I love the difference it's making in people's lives. But also we need to make sure that we're getting that energy exchange back so that we're not burning out, so that we can be teaching yoga for the rest of our life versus giving it away all for free now and then not being able to teach anymore after 5 years.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good thing to remember as well. And so I think that all of those are really valid points. I'm wondering what you, like any recommendations you have for new yoga teachers? Because I know it's a lot harder to get a job when you're a new yoga teacher. You don't have that experience. And that's a lot more when, you know, the people who will say yes to teaching for free or free karma classes, teaching at all hours of the day just because you want any experience that you can get. I'm just wondering what your recommendations are for people who are newer to the industry.
Well, I think to be creative and to find your own niche and then become the specialist in that. So say, for example, if you're a mom, then, you know, maybe you can even start up some community classes in the local community center for yoga for moms. And then they can even bring their, you know, moms and tots, and they can even bring their tots along. Or there's an aging community, and I think there's a demand for a lot of yoga classes for the aging population. Mm-hmm. So it could be that, or it could be yoga for oversized people or yoga for men, or, you know, just really starting to find some specialties, yoga for golfers, for tennis players, whoever it might be.
Yeah.
So that you can find your own niche and just make up. Like, I've been an entrepreneur for over 20 years, and I really feel as an entrepreneur, all I do is make up jobs. So I kind of look around and think like, oh, you know, where is there a demand, and then make up a job for it.
Cool. I love that.
So just being super creative and having fun with it. And also just to think about your own passions. Like, what do you love to do? I love to run. Like, okay, I'm going to do yoga classes for runners. And where do runners hang out? Oh, they hang out at the running room or the running stores and do posters there and ask if you can run classes there, or, you know, so just really think out of the box instead of, I need to get a job at the yoga studio. Like everyone else is thinking.
Yeah. Then. Yeah. I love that. I love how your whole mindset is so entrepreneurial. I think it's really inspiring.
Well, and then you always need to keep evolving. So you can't just keep, you know, you can't do the same thing all the time.
Yeah.
You need to always be moving forward as an entrepreneur too, and always be looking at the trends. Like, what are the trends out there? And be ahead of the wave versus trying to catch up after. So.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. That's a good thing to keep in mind. It's like, once something's already popular, there's already a bunch of people already sort of teaching it or doing it, and it's harder to get into that as opposed to sort of being there as it's progressing, as it's starting. And sometimes that means taking a risk too, because those things can fizzle out as well.
Mm-hmm.
Like, well, who knew Zumba would be such a trend?
Awesome.
Somebody jumped on that bandwagon not having any idea if they'd have a job in a year, I'm sure.
So great. Well, I think all entrepreneurs are like that, and you need to be okay with trying something and then not working and then not giving up, but then just trying something else. And I think anyone that's done really, really well as an entrepreneur has failed a number of times before they hit that, oh yeah, this is the one, you know,
yeah,
that it's really taken off. And there, again, you can do a bit of preventive stuff by doing some job, you know, some market research before you spend a bunch of money creating a new product or something. But sometimes you need to just take the risk, like the Zumba.
Yeah, definitely. Awesome. I just have one more question for you. I want to be mindful of your time. I was wondering if you could go back to Tracy when you first started teaching yoga, when you first came out of teacher training, what one piece of advice would you give little Tracy that you now know that you didn't know then?
Wow, that's a good question.
Thanks.
I mean, the word that just popped into my head was trust. And I think, you know, as an entrepreneur, you always need to just trust your intuition and follow your heart.
Okay.
And I do, you know, I do feel like I did that when I first got out, but not as much as I probably could have. Because I think I had, you know, some inklings in my heart, but then sort of fears came in of like, oh, who do you think you are to do that?
Yeah, and sort of like that imposter syndrome.
Yeah. So I think, again, you know, it probably, if I could look back, I'd be like, okay, just really trust what feels right for you and then just go for it and take that risk.
Mm-hmm. That's really great advice. I appreciate you sharing that.
Yay.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today.
You're welcome, Amanda. It was nice to talk to you. And I'm just excited for all the yoga teachers out there. And just it really is a beautiful job to have such a positive impact in the world.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I totally agree. Awesome.
Wonderful.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
So hopefully everyone enjoyed that interview with Tracy Delfs and got some great business tips and tricks, especially if you're looking to go more the entrepreneurial route. If you want to connect with Tracy, you can check out her website and it's tracydelfs.com. So TRACEYDELFS.com. There's a link on the show notes at www.mbomyoga.com. You can check out all the new blog posts, sign up for the newsletter, find out all about the social media on the website. And as always, thanks so much for listening. Bye for now.